Welcome to the deep dive, where we really try to unpack complex topics and, you know, give you those essential nuggets of knowledge. Today, we're embarking on a pretty fundamental journey, understanding gene expression. You know, DNA stores all our genetic information, that incredible blueprint for life, right? But how does that information actually get put to use? How does it make you, well, you? That's our mission for this deep dive, to unravel the intricate, beautiful dance of transcription and translation.
And guiding us through this molecular marvel are the incredibly insightful lectures of Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman. He just lays out these core biological processes with remarkable clarity. By the end of this, hopefully you won't just know what happens inside your cells, but you'll really grasp the why it matters, from, you know, the earliest scientific breakthroughs right up to the tireless molecular machines working in your body this very second.
Okay, so Dr. Hoffman takes us back to a really pivotal moment in biology. Once it was firmly established that DNA carries our genetic inheritance, the next massive question popped up. What does a gene do directly? Like, what's its immediate function?
Right. And this led scientists to some really ingenious experiments, maybe surprisingly, using a common bread mold, Neurospora, actually. Researchers would randomly mutate the mold with UV light, you know, creating these subtle changes in its DNA. And what they observed were pretty profound alterations in its ability to grow on what they called minimal media. That's essentially just the absolute bare necessities for life. It was a big clue that something fundamental had been messed with.
And this is where the early research really started to show its power, didn't it? Those simple bread mold experiments led to a really foundational idea, the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis.
No.
Dr. Hoffman explains how researchers found that if a particular mold strain couldn't grow, they could often, well, rescue it, you could say. They did this by adding a specific intermediate substance in a known biochemical pathway, things like ornithine, citrulline, or arginine. So what did that tell them about that connection between genes and function?
It was a huge deduction at the time. Groundbreaking, really. It suggested that each distinct step in a biochemical pathway, a step that often needs a specific enzyme to make it happen, was directly controlled by a single gene. So a mutated gene probably meant a missing or faulty enzyme. It seemed really elegant and simple at first, but, well, did that hypothesis hold up across the board?
It's fascinating how science works, how understanding evolves, isn't it? Because as more discoveries were made, that initial one gene, one enzyme idea had to broaden. We quickly learned it wasn't just enzymes. Other crucial proteins were involved too. So the concept sort of shifted to one gene, one protein. Yeah. But even that wasn't quite the full story. I mean, think about hemoglobin, the protein carrying oxygen in your blood. It's made of multiple different polypeptide chains, an alpha and a beta chain, for example. And each of those needs its own separate gene.
Exactly. So the concept got refined again to one gene, one polypeptide. But, you know, even that has exceptions, which just highlights the complexity and, honestly, the flexibility of life. For instance, Dr. Hoffman points out that not all genes even code for polypeptides. Some genes are blueprints for other types of RNA molecules that have critical jobs, like ribosomal RNA or transfer RNA. We'll get to those. And for eukaryotes like us, the story gets even more interesting. A single gene can actually lead to multiple different polypeptides. That happens through a process called alternative splicing, which we can touch on later. All of this really helps us appreciate that DNA doesn't directly build proteins. It acts more like a master blueprint for RNA, and RNA then becomes the working copy.
Okay, so we've got DNA as the master blueprint. How does that blueprint actually get used to build everything? Dr. Hoffman simplifies this nicely by breaking it down into two main stages of gene expression. First, transcription, then translation.
Right. Transcription is essentially rewriting the code. Dr. Hoffman uses a great analogy. Imagine you have a precious, irreplaceable cookbook that's your DNA kept safe in a library, and you need to send just one recipe, a gene, to the kitchen. You wouldn't send the whole original book, right? You'd make a copy of the recipe. In this cell, DNA's language is nucleotides, and RNA's language is also nucleotides. So when DNA is transcribed into messenger RNA, we call it mRNA, that's the temporary working copy of the recipe, is just copying the message in essentially the same language of nucleic acids.
But here's where the fundamental shift happens. Translation is a complete change in language. You're going from that nucleic acid language, the nucleotides and mRNA, to the completely different language of amino acids. And amino acids are the building blocks of a polypeptide, a protein. This is exactly why DNA indirectly determines your traits and functions. It absolutely has to go through these two distinct steps.
And this brings up a really important point about where these processes happen in the cell. Dr. Hoffman illustrates this fundamental difference between simple prokaryotic cells like bacteria and more complex eukaryotic cells like ours. In prokaryotes, which don't have a nucleus, both transcription and translation happen right there together in the cytoplasm. This makes it super streamlined, incredibly direct, and really rapid.
Yeah, but in contrast, for eukaryotes, our cells like to compartmentalize things, keep things organized. So transcription happens safely tucked away inside the nucleus where all the DNA is kept. Translation then occurs separately out in the cytoplasm on ribosomes. This separation means that the mRNA produced in eukaryotes needs some crucial modifications. It needs processing before it's ready to leave the nucleus and be translated. It's kind of like proofreading and editing that recipe copy before it's allowed out of the library, you know?
Okay.
Let's unpack transcription first. Dr. Hoffman breaks it down into three logical stages: initiation, elongation, and termination.
Exactly. Initiation is all about starting in the right place. The cell needs to know where a specific gene begins. So there's a specific DNA sequence called a promoter, which acts like a clear start here signal. It's the spot where RNA polymerase, that's the cell's dedicated enzyme for copying DNA into RNA, binds on. Binding there essentially turns on that specific gene.
What's really clever about this, especially in eukaryotes, is how gene expression is controlled. Dr. Hoffman points out that RNA polymerase doesn't just like land there and start copying on its own. It usually needs other helper proteins called transcription factors to bind to the promoter region first. So these transcription factors, which interestingly are themselves products of other genes, act like gatekeepers, or maybe molecular switches. They precisely control when and how much a gene gets expressed. It's a really key regulatory point for all your cells.
Uh-huh. Once that initiation complex is all set up, we move into elongation. This is where RNA polymerase really gets to work. It moves steadily along one strand of the DNA. We call that the template strand. And as it moves, it's laying down complementary RNA nucleotides one by one, matching them up to the DNA template. It's continuously extending and making that messenger RNA transcript longer and longer.
And finally, termination, the end of the line. The RNA polymerase eventually encounters a specific sequence on the DNA that signals the end of the gene. It's like a stop sign. At this point, the newly made RNA transcript is released. The DNA strands just naturally zip back up together, reforming their double helix. And the gene is effectively off again, but it's immediately ready to be transcribed again if the cell needs more of that particular protein. All right, so now we have this mRNA blueprint ready to go. We get to the absolute core of translation, the genetic code. Dr. Hoffman lays out the sort of mathematical puzzle the cell had to solve. You've only got four RNA letters, A, U, G, C, but you need to specify 20 different amino acids. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's really quite ingenious how evolution figured this out. Using single nucleotides only gives you four possibilities. Not enough. Combinations of two nucleotides, that gives you 4 times 4, which is 16 possibilities. Still not enough for 20 amino acids. But if you use groups of three nucleotides, we call these codons, you get 4 times 4 times 4, which is 64 possible combinations.
Yeah.
That's more than enough. And this is exactly what the genetic code does. Each three nucleotide codon specifies a particular amino acid, or sometimes a stop signal.
And what's just mind-blowing, really, and Dr. Hoffman emphasizes this as powerful evidence for a single common ancestor for all organisms, is that this is the genetic code. It's virtually universal across almost all life on Earth, from bacteria to humans.
Exactly. And this universality isn't just some cool biological trivia. It's the fundamental basis of modern genetic engineering. It's the reason scientists can actually take a gene from a firefly that allows it to glow and insert it into, say, a tobacco plant, making the plant glow.
Right, or that jellyfish gene making a pig glow. I've seen pictures of that.
Precisely. How is that even possible? It's because the tobacco plant cells and the pig cells read and understand the exact same genetic words, the same codons as the firefly and the jellyfish. It's like a shared biological language that stretches back billions of years. Just amazing.
Dr. Hoffman also highlights two really crucial properties of this code. First, he says it's redundant. What does that mean?
Redundant means that multiple different codons can specify the exact same amino acid. Think of it like having synonyms in a language. For example, there are 6 different 3-letter codons that all code for the amino acid leucine. C-U-U, C-U-C, C-U-A, C-G, U-A, U-U-G. They all mean leucine.
Okay, so redundancy, what's the second property?
The second property, which is critically important for everything to work right, is that the code is not ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
So while multiple codons can mean the same amino acid, redundancy, every individual codon specifies only one specific amino acid. A given codon, like AUG, will always mean methionine, never anything else in that context. This non-ambiguity is absolutely vital. If a codon could mean different things at different times, you'd end up with proteins with incorrect shapes. and they wouldn't be able to do their jobs. Your cells just wouldn't function properly.
Got it. Redundant, but not ambiguous. And we also learn about special codons that act like punctuation marks in the code.
That's right. There's the start codon, which is almost always AUG. This codon does two things. It signals where translation should begin, and it also codes for the amino acid methionine, which is why pretty much all newly synthesized polypeptides universally begin with methionine, although it often gets removed later.
Okay, and the stop signs?
And then there are three different stop codons, UAA, UAG, and UGA. As their name suggests, they don't code for any amino acid. They just signal the end of translation, full stop.
All right, so the mRNA blueprint has the message, the code is understood. Now it's time for the actual building process, translation. Dr. Hoffman describes this happening on ribosomes, these tiny, bustling molecular factories. They're made of ribosomal RNA, that's rRNA, and various proteins all working together.
So you have the factory, the ribosome, the blueprint, the mRNA. But how do the right raw materials, the amino acids, get delivered to the factory in exactly the right sequence? This is where another type of RNA comes in, transfer RNA, or tRNA. You think of tRNA as the cell's specialized delivery truck. Each tRNA molecule is folded into a very specific kind of L-shape or clover leaf shape. And crucially, each tRNA has two important ends. One end has a unique three-nucleotide sequence called an anticodon. This anticodon is complementary to a specific mRNA codon. It can base pair with it, and the other end carries the precise amino acid specified by that mRNA codon.
Okay, but how does the tRNA know which amino acid to pick up? That seems critical.
It absolutely is. The tRNA itself doesn't know. It needs help. There's a set of highly specific enzymes called aminoacyl tRNA synthetases. There's basically one synthetase for each amino acid. This enzyme acts like a matchmaker. It recognizes a specific amino acid, AND, its corresponding tRNA molecule.
Mm-hmm.
Then, using energy from ATP, the cell's main energy currency, it accurately attaches the correct amino acid to its specific tRNA. This charging step is absolutely critical. It's the point where the genetic information is truly translated from the nucleotide language to the amino acid language. Ensuring fidelity here is paramount.
Wow. Okay. So now we have these charged tRNAs ready with their amino acid cargo. Where do they go?
They head to the ribosome. Once charged, these aminoacyl tRNAs enter the ribosome through specific binding sites. You can think of these as slots, usually called the A, P, and E sites. A for aminoacyl, P for peptidyl, E for exit. The mRNA molecule is threaded through the ribosome, kind of like a tape moving through a reader, one codon at a time. As each mRNA codon lines up in the A site, the appropriate tRNA, the one with the matching anticodon, arrives, bringing in the next amino acid for the growing chain.
Then comes the core repetitive part of translation, right? Elongation.
Exactly. This is where the protein chain actually grows. An amino acid is transferred from the tRNA in the P site onto the amino acid carried by the tRNA in the A site, forming a peptide bond. Then the ribosome shifts, or translocates, along the mRNA by exactly one codon. The tRNA that just dropped off its amino acid moves to the E site and exits. The tRNA holding the growing chain moves into the P site, and the A site is now open for the next charged tRNA to come in. This cycle repeats over and over: codon recognition, peptide bond formation, translocation.
And you mentioned this is energy intensive.
Oh, yeah. Surprisingly so. Dr. Hoffman notes it requires energy, often from GTP, another energy molecule, for both binding the tRNA and for the translocation step. So basically, two GTPs are used for every single amino acid added after the initial methionine. Building proteins takes a lot of cellular energy.
Okay, so elongation builds the chain. How does it finally stop?
It stops when one of those three stop codons, UAA, UAG, or UGA, eventually arrives in the A site of the ribosome. What's unique here, as Dr. Hoffman explains, is that there's no tRNA molecule that has an anticodon for a stop codon. They don't carry amino acids. Instead, a special protein called a release factor recognizes the stop codon and binds to the A site. This binding acts as a signal. It triggers the immediate completion of the polypeptide chain, causing it to be released from the tRNA in the P site, and it also causes the rapid disassembly of the whole translation complex. The ribosome subunit separate, the mRNA is released, and the tRNAs float away. Job is done.
And talk about cellular efficiency. Your cells are amazing at it. Dr. Hoffman highlights this thing called the polyribosome or polysome. What's that?
It's a fantastic example of efficiency. A polysome is basically one mRNA molecule being translated by multiple ribosomes simultaneously. As soon as one ribosome moves down the mRNA a bit, another one can hop onto the start codon and begin translating. So you get this structure that looks like beads on a string. The string is the mRNA, and the beads are ribosomes, each making a copy of the protein.
So you can make many copies really fast.
Exactly. It allows the cell to churn out many copies of a needed protein from just one mRNA blueprint very, very quickly. crucial when there's high demand.
Okay, so the ribosome builds the polypeptide chain. But Dr. Hoffman reminds us that even after translation, it's not always ready for action, right? Many proteins need further modifications, or maybe they need to be sent to a specific place in the cell, or even outside the cell.
That's right. And this raises another important question. How does the cell manage all that? How does it know which proteins need tweaking and where they're supposed to go? Well, the cell has another remarkably clever system for this, often involving the protein itself. For certain proteins, especially those destined for secretion or for specific organelles like the endoplasmic reticulum or lysosomes, the very first sequence of amino acids to emerge from the ribosome acts as a special tag. It's called the signal peptide, basically an address label built right into the beginning of the protein.
And what happens when that signal peptide emerges? It sounds like more molecular choreography.
It absolutely is. A specialized protein complex floating in the cytoplasm, called a signal recognition particle, or SRP, recognizes and binds tightly to this signal peptide as it emerges from the ribosome. This binding actually pauses translation temporarily. Then this whole complex, the ribosome, the partially made polypeptide, and the bound SRP gets targeted and docks onto the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, the RER. It docks via an SRP receptor protein that's embedded in the RER membrane. The RER, remember, is that network of membranes often involved in protein synthesis and modification, studded with ribosomes, hence the rough appearance.
Okay, so it docks onto the RER. Then what?
This precise docking positions the ribosome right over a protein channel, or pore, in the RER membrane. Translation then resumes, and the growing polypeptide chain is threaded through this pore directly into the RER lumen, that's the space inside the RER, or sometimes it gets integrated right into the RER membrane itself if it's destined to be a membrane protein.
And inside the RER is where modifications can happen.
Exactly. Once inside or within the membrane, various things can occur. The initial methionine might be cleaved off by an enzyme. Sugars might be added in a process called glycosylation, which is common for secreted or membrane proteins. Disulfide bonds might form to stabilize the protein structure. Or multiple polypeptide chains might fold and assemble together to form a larger functional protein complex, like the alpha and beta chains coming together inside the RER to eventually form hemoglobin. All these modifications are absolutely essential. They ensure the protein folds into its correct, intricate three-dimensional shape. And that 3D shape is absolutely fundamental for its function. If the shape is wrong, the protein usually can't do its job properly, if at all.
Now, these processes are incredibly precise, but things can still go wrong sometimes.
Mm.
Dr. Hoffman then delves into what happens when the genetic code, that DNA blueprint, isn't perfectly maintained. We call these changes mutations. He focuses particularly on point mutations, which are changes at just a single nucleotide position in the DNA. Small change, potentially big impact.
Right. And point mutations come in a few key flavors. One common type is a base pair substitution, where one nucleotide base pair, like AT, is simply swapped for another, like GC.
And some of these substitutions are surprisingly harmless, right? Dr. Hoffman calls them silent mutations.
Exactly. They change the DNA sequence, yes. But because of the genetic code's redundancy, remember, multiple codons can mean the same amino acid. The altered codon might still code for the exact same amino acid. So the DNA is different, the mRNA is different, but the final protein sequence is identical. No effect on function. The cell has this built-in buffer, you could say.
Okay, but what if the substitution does change the amino acid?
Then you have what's called a missense mutation. Missense means it makes a different sense in terms of the amino acid sequence. And this can have profound effects sometimes, but not always. It depends on which amino acid is changed and where it is in the protein. Dr. Hoffman uses the really powerful classic example of sickle cell disease. A single nucleotide change, just one letter difference in the DNA sequence for one of the hemoglobin chains, leads to just one amino acid being swapped for another. Glutamic acid becomes valine at position 6 of the beta chain. This seemingly tiny change drastically alters how the hemoglobin protein behaves, especially under low oxygen conditions. It causes the protein to clump together, deforming red blood cells into that characteristic sickle shape. This leads to all the serious health problems associated with the disease. It's a very stark illustration of how critical even one amino acid can be.
Wow. And even more severe, potentially, is a nonsense mutation.
Yes, a nonsense mutation is where a base substitution changes a codon that normally specifies an amino acid into one of the three stop codons.
Yeah.
So imagine reading a recipe, and halfway through a step, it just says STOP. protein synthesis halts prematurely at that point. You end up with a truncated, usually non-functional protein. These often have very significant, usually detrimental effects on the cell or organism.
Okay, so substitutions can be silent, missense, or nonsense. What about other types of mutations?
Dr. Hoffman also emphasizes another critical category, insertions or deletions of nucleotides, sometimes called indels. These are often far more disruptive than substitutions, especially if they occur within the coding sequence of a gene. If you add or remove just one or two nucleotides, it causes what's known as a frame shift.
A frame shift, like shifting the reading frame.
Precisely. Think about reading a sentence made of only three-letter words, like, the fat cat ate the rat. If you remove the F from fat, the reading frame shifts and you get the ATC ATA tetherat. Everything downstream is garbled. A frame shift mutation messes up the entire downstream sequence of codons. Every amino acid coded for after the insertion or deletion point is likely to be wrong. This almost always leads to a completely non-functional protein, often truncated early due to a shifted frame encountering a stopped codon by chance.
It's really important to remember, though, that these random mutations, while sometimes harmful, are the ultimate source of genetic variation. They're the raw material for evolution, right?
Absolutely. Most mutations are probably neutral, having no real effect. Many are harmful, like the one causing sickle cell disease, though even that has a complex story in malaria-prone regions. But very, very rarely, a mutation might turn out to be beneficial. It might create a slightly different protein or alter gene regulation in a way that gives an organism an advantage in its particular environment. Over long periods, natural selection can favor these rare beneficial mutations, leading to adaptation and evolution. It's this constant microscopic trial and error process driving the diversity of life.
Now, we touched on this earlier, the differences between prokaryotes and eukaryotes in gene expression. Dr. Hoffman circles back to really emphasize a crucial distinction. In prokaryotes, transcription and translation can be coupled. What does that mean exactly?
Coupled means they happen essentially at the same time and place. In a prokaryotic cell, which lacks a nucleus, as soon as the front end of an mRNA molecule starts peeling off the DNA during transcription, ribosomes can immediately latch onto that front end and start translating it into protein, even while the rest of the mRNA molecule is still being transcribed further down the DNA.
Wow, so the protein starts getting made before the mRNA blueprint is even finished.
Exactly. Imagine the efficiency. It's like chefs starting to cook from the beginning of a recipe while the scribe is still writing out the later steps.
That's incredible speed. Vital for single-celled organisms, I guess.
Absolutely vital. It allows bacteria and other prokaryotes to respond incredibly rapidly to changes in their environment by quickly producing the proteins they need right when they need them. It perfectly reflects their fundamental cellular organization.
Yeah.
They've essentially traded the compartmentalization we see in eukaryotes for sheer speed and directness.
But that eukaryotic complexity with the nucleus, the mRNA processing, like splicing, it offers a different kind of advantage, doesn't it?
It does. That process we mentioned earlier, alternative mRNA splicing, is a great example. Before the mRNA leaves the nucleus in eukaryotes, non-coding sections called introns are cut out, and the coding sections, exons, are stitched together. But the clever part is that the cell can sometimes stitch those exons together in different combinations.
On the same gene.
From the very same initial RNA transcript copied from a single gene. By splicing it differently, the cell can produce multiple distinct mRNA molecules, each coding for a slightly different but related polypeptide. This is a major reason why organisms like us, humans, with maybe only around 20,000 or so protein coding genes, can actually produce a much larger and more diverse array of proteins, maybe hundreds of thousands. It adds a huge layer of regulatory complexity and functional diversity.
What an absolutely incredible journey through this world of gene expression. Dr. Hoffman's explanations really illuminate how precise and, well, elegant it all is, from that, you know, humble bread mold experiment paving the way right up to the complex dance of these molecular machines working away inside your own cells this very moment. It's just clear how fundamental these processes are to all of life.
Yeah, we've really unpacked how that genetic information stored safely in your DNA is first transcribed into a working copy, RNA, and then meticulously translated into the functional proteins that are the true workhorses of the cell. They drive nearly every single process in your body, from breaking down your lunch to letting you see these words or hear our voices. It really is a testament to nature's incredible efficiency, its complexity, and its constant adaptation through evolution.
So when you think about it, what does this all mean for you personally listening right now? every single trait you possess, every protein your body is manufacturing, every single function your cells are carrying out, it's all a direct result of this incredibly intricate, finely tuned machinery operating hopefully flawlessly within you. It's happening constantly, billions upon billions of times over, second by second.
It may be connecting this back to that bigger picture Dr. Hoffman touched on, the universality of the genetic code. It really does make you wonder, doesn't it, if that code is such powerful evidence of our shared common ancestry. What other fundamental biological mechanisms, maybe ones we're still just beginning to understand in detail, might reveal similar deep connections, similar threads tying together all the diverse forms of life on this planet? It's a question that keeps driving science forward.
Absolutely. We hope this deep dive has given you a fresh, maybe deeper appreciation for the hidden, dynamic, molecular world that exists within every one of us. It's truly awe-inspiring when you start to grasp it. Until next time, keep digging, keep learning.